Hello, my name is John Schaefer and welcome to The Wealth Show from Citywire. Ahead of next month's COP26 event, I spoke with Jefferies Global Head of ESG Research, Aniket Shah, to get his views on how asset managers can become net zero investors. We spoke about how investors should tackle challenging areas such as oil majors and miners, and dig into Shah's latest report.
What are the 8 steps for investors to become net zero?
We hosted a summit recently to bring some clarity to the whole net zero conversation. And our view about net zero investing is that it has to be geographically based. And you have to actually understand what would it require for a country to go down a net zero pathway before we can figure out what does it mean for an investor to go down a net zero pathway. So we started off looking at the US, and after the summit, we came up with 8 clear takeaways. So number one is net zero investors in the US should cease making incremental investments into fossil fuels. Number two, net zero investors in the US should invest in renewables. Solar and wind are good places to start because there is an enormous need for a ramp up of renewables. Third is we'll require CCS, storage and carbon capture. And in addition to that, we will need green hydrogen for certain hard to abate markets. So those are places and areas that will need more investment. Fourth is we believe that all companies need to align their disclosures and targets with established frameworks, in particular, SASB for material ESG risks, TCFD for climate risk, and the science-based targets initiatives for forward-looking climate goals. Fifth, our view is any net zero investor should make sure their companies are not participating in political action committees or action groups that support the delaying of action on climate change. Of course, such a big part of the solution is changes in policy. And we're seeing more and more investors asking, how are their portfolio companies behaving in Washington? What are they supporting? And for us, it's very clear that we need policy to be in line with a major transition. Our sixth point is that companies need to be transparent on net zero and provide the necessary disclosures to track net zero investments and returns. Here, we mean specifically how much money is being put in green capex, how much revenues are being gotten from green investments, and also how much is being used from the offset market. Seven is we believe companies need to enter strategic partnerships to lower their greenhouse gas intensity. We're seeing this across the board that businesses in the hydrocarbon sector are partnering or acquiring other businesses that can move them down more quickly a net zero path. This is corporate activity that we think is very important to accelerate the net zero transition. And finally, all of this has to be in line with very clear national level energy pathways. And we are big fans here in the United States of the Princeton Net Zero America Project. It served as a cornerstone, frankly, of our first summit and a lot of our thinking on these issues. And we think having a external pathway alongside which a company invests and an asset manager therefore invests through the company makes a lot of sense.
You mentioned in your report avoiding investment in fossil fuels. And I think the main defense of energy companies is that they're some of the biggest investors in renewable energy, especially in the UK. You know, the likes of BP and Shell, some of the biggest stocks on the FTSE are also some of the biggest investors in renewable energy. So how should an asset manager or an investor tackle that?
Asset managers need to ask for companies to have very clear net zero or Paris aligned transition pathways. And then investors need to interrogate those pathways. They need to see if those pathways are actually in line with the Paris Agreement. And for this, investors need to be very clear about what does it mean to be aligned with the Paris Agreement. In my reading, the Paris Agreement is very clear. We want to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius with an upper limit of 2. For that, we have a very clear carbon budget. And that carbon budget, at different levels of probability to stay under that carbon budget, means effectively no incremental investments in fossil fuels, period. This is what the International Energy Agency told the world earlier this year in their net zero scenario. So although it is true that many of the oil majors are also large investors in renewable energy, that doesn't mean that the oil majors should continue making incremental investments in fossil fuels. It means that they should be dedicating a larger and larger and soon basically all of their additional capital expenditures into the renewables or the non-hydrocarbon economy. That is to say, if we're actually serious about net zero. If we're not serious about net zero, John, then that's fine. Let's just be honest with each other and let companies be honest with investors and let investors be honest with their constituencies and say, hey, look, we are trying to transition as quickly as we can. It might take 100 years. It might take 150 years. We're going to blow past these budgets, and that's okay. But the way I was, you know, the way I was trained, the way I look at things is if we agreed to something, then we have to be honest about its implications, and we need to push towards those implications. And therefore, it is just incongruous today for a company to be net zero and be making incremental investments in fossil fuels. That's what the International Energy Agency tells us very, very clearly.
So in reality, it would mean the oil majors just have to turn the tap off on fossil fuel investment or fossil fuel production.
Yep, that's right.
Completely, right.
And by the way, and that is a challenge because here's the point, right? We are a fossil fuel addicted global economy. That is the challenge with all of this. And that, by the way, is not the oil majors' fault in the short term. Long term, we all know that the oil majors played a big role in spreading disinformation about climate change and so on and so forth over the last 50 years. But in the short term, right now, when we wake up in the morning and we live our daily lives, we live our lives in a fossil fuel economy, period. 85% of the world's primary energy roughly comes from fossil fuels. That's the world we live in. And so what, you know, the investor has to ask within that ecosystem, what can they do? And in our mind, the most important thing that investors can do is push for a transition and to invest into the transition. So we're not saying divest from oil majors. We're saying push oil majors to make more investments into renewable energy, because that is what we need. And it won't be perfect, and the companies will come back and say, but there's still demand for and there's still demand and growing demand, by the way, for fossil fuels. And frankly, that is an issue that government needs to also solve and consumers need to solve. Governments need to solve this through corrective pricing, carbon pricing, et cetera. Consumers need to solve this by saying, hey, we are going to transition in our purchasing behavior, in our car buying behavior and so on, away from fossil fuel intensive products. So it is this entire system that needs to evolve. But what we're saying is that one thing is very clear is over time, we need more investment to go into the transition. For that to happen, companies need to put out credible transition plans and stick to it.
I think it's quite interesting that the last month or so has exposed that reliance on fossil fuels globally. I mean, we're in a bit of an energy crisis at the moment. It's obviously particularly bad in the UK. Not sure what the situation with sort of queues for fuel are in New York, etc. But I mean, how much do we need to do to get to a point where we're not so reliant on fossil fuels?
We need to basically increase our investment in renewable energy and associated infrastructure by a factor of five globally. That's what we need to do if we're going to actually start solving the addiction that we have to fossil fuels. We need major step up of investment in renewable energy and interconnected grids, in hydrogen and in different forms of carbon capture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And for that to happen, I think investors are there, John. I think they really do want to make those investments. One of the things that I'm always amazed by is when there's a green bond issuance or a renewable energy company issuing stock or a climate tech company going public, the amount of capital that goes into these businesses is much more than these companies can absorb. So investors are there. But we need to basically increase the supply. It's not a demand issue, I don't think, from an investment perspective. But the long and the short of it is that we need to increase our investment in all things renewable and green by a factor of 4 to 5 year after year for the next 30 years. And if we do that, then we have a shot.
Let's move on to miners. Obviously, there's a slightly challenging approach that investors have with miners. Obviously, there's this massive need for raw materials at the moment to sort of put into batteries and some of the kind of methods for renewable energy. But at the same time, miners have a pretty bad history on ESG. So how should asset managers approach miners and what can miners do better at the moment?
Yeah, so when we think about ESG, we think about it in two ways. One is how does the company operate? And secondly, what's the product that they create? As you rightly said, the mining sector, like all sectors, has frankly struggled with both. In terms of how the companies themselves operate, you know, there need to be significant improvements to reduce carbon footprint. There really needs to be a greater focus on how these companies are proactively and positively engaging with local communities, because there are enormous issues right now with mining and local communities all around Latin America, Africa, in terms of their relationships with one another, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's significant, and we've seen a lot of positive steps in both of those directions. Then there's the question of what do the companies themselves produce? And here, as you rightly say, there is an enormous, two-sided coin of what the mining companies do. On the one hand, you have miners that are actually producing and exploring for coal. We need to seize our use of coal as quickly as possible. And that is something that we think is just absolutely critical for the Paris Agreement. And we are seeing, for example, some companies that have come out and said that they will run their coal mines for cash until depletion and not make incremental investments into coal. And I think that is a very good first step. Secondly is then this question that you raised around how do these mining companies produce the types of minerals that are needed for the renewable energy transition. Frankly, there isn't a good answer for this right now, because as it stands today, for us to use electric vehicles and for us to use renewable energy, it's just going to require a lot of copper, a lot of nickel, a lot of cobalt. And there are many people in the sustainable development world who think that the environmental and biodiversity implications of that are terrible, and frankly, ones that could have a tremendous long-term negative implication for the environment.
When you say tremendous, is it worse than fossil fuels?
This is one of the issues that I think the ESG crowd needs to spend more time thinking about. And we are certainly doing that at Jefferies. And one of the things that it leads to, John, of course, is that we actually, the only way we solve these kinds of problems of, you know, how do 8 billion to 10 billion people live on this planet is there has to be just less consumption on the one hand, right? Or there needs to be major technological improvements so that we can live these kinds of lives and have these kinds of products without the material footprint use that we are currently using. And so this is an outstanding question, and we think investors need to debate that more. In other words, is our current system one that is just irreconcilable with planetary boundaries? There are lots of people, by the way, who would agree, who would say the answer is yes. I mean, I'm reminded of Professor Stephen Chu, who is a Nobel laureate and the former Secretary of the Energy in the United States. He's a Nobel laureate in physics, who has said publicly that the only way we solve the environmental crisis is by moving away from a growth-oriented economy. that would be obviously a complete game changer in terms of intellectual thought and how our capital markets work, how our businesses operate, and so on. Because I have this privileged job of running ESG research in a global bank, we're going to explore this as objectively as we can. And it's something that we think more and more of our investor clients need to think about too.
I think that's all very well as in theory, but getting the global population to get on board with that is another thing.
It is, but first you have to have the right diagnosis of the problem, John. If you don't have the right diagnosis of the problem, then we can't talk about tools and interventions unless we diagnose it right. And I think a lot of things are becoming clear about the complexities of the energy transition right now as we speak, and the complexities of this environmental transition.
Obviously, we've got COP26 coming up in Glasgow later this year. How much impact do you think that's going to have on asset managers and their approach to net zero targets?
COP26 is a big moment. It is a moment that, frankly, we've been waiting for a couple of years now. And we all should be looking at it from a perspective of what's going to change. You know, what is going to come out of COP26 that will either be a signal to markets or a signal to business or a signal to policymakers that we're going down a different path. And in our view, the most important things that from an investor's perspective that can come out of COP26, by the way, won't come out of the actual COP26, which is a negotiation between governments, but in and around COP26 are the following. Number one is a clear, globally accepted framework and standard around climate risk at the company level, around disclosures at the company level, and also around what does it mean for investors and banks and asset managers and so on to be net zero aligned. And so we have high focus on this GFENS, this Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero, and whatever their efforts are going to be around COP26. So that's number one, sort of what is happening in terms of the structure of capital markets around COP, and is there anything significant that shifts the debate or shifts capital in that way? The second area that we think is very, very important is what does the United States, what is their positioning? And what is China's positioning? Recall, of course, that COP21 only happened really because the US and China made an agreement to make it happen a year before COP21, right? It was that diplomatic effort between the US and China that paved the way for other countries to get on board. Right now, the relationship between US and China is very different. And these two countries are very different countries than they were, frankly, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So we are looking a lot, and as you follow our research, you know, we're writing a lot about what's happening in Washington. What is the ability of the Congress to pass significant, longstanding climate investments? And similarly, we're looking into what the government of China is going to come to COP26 with. Whether it's a increase in ambition, a increase in their nationally determined contributions, et cetera, et cetera. So that's number two. That's our second big area of interest and focus, and that'll give us a sense of where the world is going. And then on COP26. And then the third thing that we think is very important about whether the Conference of the Parties remains a mainstay in climate discussions and negotiations is this famous $100 billion number, which is an agreement that high-income countries made with low-income countries that by this year there would be $100 billion of annual flow from high-income to low-income countries to deal with climate mitigation and adaptation. And we are not at $100 billion yet. The question is, do we get to $100 billion? And then does that number increase?
Why would that $100 billion improve climate change?
Because most of the world's emissions today come from low and middle income countries, and they need significant support from high income countries to continue to grow and transition away from the hydrocarbon sector over the next 30 years.
I mean, couldn't you argue that the West plus China really are the bigger emitters rather than emerging markets?
Yeah. Yeah, today, but all future growth effectively in emissions will be in emerging markets.
Okay. And how will that money help?
You have to invest in making the cost of renewables cheaper. You need to invest in hard infrastructure. So, you know, in most countries in Africa, there isn't a well-functioning grid into which you can plug in renewables. So there's core infrastructure needs. That's all on the mitigation side, by the way. The investments would be needed for mitigation to a low-carbon development pathway for emerging markets. And then there's money that's needed for adaptation, which is to say that these countries are feeling day-to-day the brunt of climate change, and they need capital to help support them through that transition.
Just drilling down a little bit on COP26, do you think the event itself could be market moving potentially? Do you think that we could see a lot of divestment amongst asset managers post the event?
It's possible. In general, I don't think COPs are market moving events. I think they give a very clear sort of signal around the importance of climate change and the fact that the global leaders are thinking about this very seriously. So I think if anything, it continues the positive sentiment and momentum around climate. But I don't think there will be a moment, a specific announcement or a specific thing that will necessarily lead to a major market moving event.
I wanted to look at China. Obviously, it's been a pretty difficult topic with Evergrande recently. But how should asset managers tackle investment in China from a net zero perspective?
In some ways, China is doing a lot already on net zero. China is the world's largest investor in renewable energy. Until recently, it was larger than all of Europe put together. China is also the world's largest deployer of electric vehicles. China has made lots of commitments and investments in research and development in clean energy and associated technologies. So in some ways, you know, China is making a lot of the strides that are needed to help not just its own economy, but the whole global economy transition. And I think nothing is more powerful than technology and the investments that they're making in technology, from a lot of it directed by the state. The challenge, of course, with China is that it is still, relatively speaking, you know, compared to the West, it is a developing part of the world. I mean, at the aggregate level, on a PPP basis, China's economy is roughly the size of the United States. But on a per capita basis, not using purchasing power parity, it is still a fraction of high income world economic output per person. And so all of this is to say is that China still has a lot of development that it wants to do. And entire regions of the country still need hundreds of millions of people still need and would like to get, you know, out of poverty, out of agrarian life, and into a more service-oriented and manufacturing-oriented urban living, which requires significant emissions. So I think for asset managers to understand China and to be, thinking about China, for us, again, the key question is understand the pathway to net zero, understand what are the transitional sectors that need more investment. So, you know, where do you need to put investments into? And then where do you need to actually withhold investments, or where do the companies that you invest in need to withhold investments? And we think that that is the right place to start with that question. In China, there have been some very important modeling exercises done on how the Chinese economy can evolve to a net zero pathway. And we think those should be the starting points of these types of investments.
Is there a slight amount of hypocrisy there, though? I mean, we've seen with the Evergrande crisis, sort of all these huge amount of empty properties that have been built. There was something like enough room for 70 million people in empty properties in China, a statistic that I saw. And that shows that there's this sort of almost wasteful growth mindset rather than, I mean, you know, you mentioned all the things that the Chinese government's trying to do on ESG, but that doesn't seem to be completely true there, does it?
Well, both things are true at the same time, which is just the complication of how the world works. You know, it is true that China is a major investor in renewable energy. It is true that the Chinese have made major strides on EVs. And it is true that they have had a developmental trajectory and a developmental path that has, according to some, had led to excesses and property bubbles and construction, you know, overbuilds and so on and so forth. So both things are true, just like they are true around for any other part of the world, that there are positives and negatives when it comes to how countries evolve and develop. And so we have to always, you know, it's sort of fashionable these days, I think, to focus only on China and to critique China for its efforts. But I think we all have to look much more in our backyards too, to see what are the sort of contradictions of development and contradictions of financial excess and so on and so forth that has become just part and parcel of how a lot of the system works today.
Well, Aniket, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.